Chapter 29 Spoils of War. On his first full day in office, March 5th, Grant, with brisk military efficiency, produced his first list of cabinet appointees. Washburn, Stuart, Borey, Creswell, Hoar, and Cox, and John Rawlins materialized on the Senate floor to present it. Grant, it turned out, had overlooked an antiquated statute introduced by Alexander Hamilton in forging the Treasury Department in 1789 that no Treasury Secretary could be directly or indirectly involved in trade or commerce. A flustered Grant discovered this provision only after Alexander T. Stuart was unanimously confirmed by the Senate. Stuart offered to place his profits in a trust while in office, with the proceeds donated to charity, but that didn't solve the predicament. Grant pursued a failed effort to have Congress pass a resolution exempting Stuart from the law. In the end, he withdrew the nomination, the whole debacle reflecting his inexperience and refusal to seek counsel before selecting cabinet secretaries. Instead of Stuart, Grant proposed Congressman George Boutwell of Massachusetts, the first Commissioner of Internal Revenue during the war. Heavily touted by radicals, the former Massachusetts governor had been an early backer of the Republican Party and a stout supporter of Reconstruction. A fire-breathing House manager in the Andrew Johnson impeachment, he had excoriated the president as an apostate and a traitor. As a confirmed abolitionist, he had been instrumental in passing both the 14th and 15th Amendments. Boutwell was not an endearing personality. One colleague found him cold, calculating, and without confidences. But he reflected Grant's emphasis on defending the rights of newly freed blacks. Within days, Grant sent to Capitol Hill the names of a second batch of appointees, including Boutwell and Rawlins, and they were duly rubber-stamped. Elihu Washburn, having served as Secretary of State for all of 5 days, was now confirmed as Minister to France, with Hamilton Fish chosen to run the State Department on a permanent basis. With his long face, wide mouth, wavy hair, and scraggly side whiskers, Fish was Grant's most inspired choice. The squire of a Hudson River estate where Grant had stayed, the 60-year-old Fish was a former New York governor and senator, a cultivated patrician fluent in 4 languages. With his Whig background, impeccable judgment, and long experience, he described himself as an old fogey with traditional notions of honesty. In a cabinet plagued by high turnover, he would labor for 8 years, lending gravity to American foreign policy and riding out many controversies. He functioned on such confidential terms with Grant that he almost ranked as his prime minister. Steeped in statecraft, he would master reams of information, keep a voluminous diary, and tutor Grant in the mysterious ways of diplomacy. For Grant, Fish was a godsend, compensating for his own glaring inexperience in foreign affairs. Grant later boasted, with some justice, that Hamilton Fish was the best Secretary of State in 50 years. While historians have tended to mock Grant's cabinet as a bunch of mediocrities, and Borey certainly qualified as such, it was actually weighted with former congressmen, senators, governors, and judges. It had figures of real distinction, Fish, radical Republicans, Boutwell, Creswell, men of exceptional intellect, Hoar, and advocates of civil service reform, Cox. Rutherford B. Hayes was enraptured by Grant's freedom from party hacks. His cabinet looks like a revolution. It is an attempt to put fitness and qualification before what is called claims and political services. If anybody could overthrow the spoils doctrine and practice, Grant is the man. The trouble lay less with the caliber of choices than an absence of any ideological cohesion. Grant didn't want his cabinet ruled by a monolithic party line, which was praiseworthy, but this sometimes resulted in a fragmentation of views that would bedevil his administration. In this heyday of the spoils system, Grant had thrown down a gauntlet to party leaders. In response, they patronized him as a dunderhead and lashed out at his choices. Senator John Sherman said Grant's attempt to form a cabinet without consultation with anyone and with very little knowledge except social intercourse with the persons appointed, cast doubt on his presidency. After seeing Grant, Ben Butler growled that he is stupidly dull and ignorant and no more comprehends his duty or his power under the Constitution than that dog, indicating a small dog nearby. Charles Sumner, the all-powerful chairman of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, took special umbrage at not being consulted about the Secretary of State, perhaps because he coveted the plum assignment himself. Unfortunately, Grant's reforming spirit backfired, since he had to make amends to spurned politicians on Capitol Hill and only ended up more beholden to them. Grant exhibited another serious defect in managing appointments. In the fast-moving world of warfare, it was a virtue to act decisively and make snap judgments based on intuition. In the White House, by contrast, he was too quick to hire people, then too quick to fire them. If this style served Grant well in the fog of war, where improvisation was vital, it led to some rough clashes and bruised feelings in the political sphere. Instead of seeming simple and direct, he could come across as brusque and even insensitive. Where he should have deliberated and calculated, he sometimes rushed into headlong action, as if storming an enemy fort. Critics have faulted Grant for applying a rigid military model to his cabinet secretaries, treating them as so many staff officers. Ebenezer Hoare later complained that Grant had the most crude and imperfect notions of the proper relationship with his cabinet, leading to his interfering with the duties which the law imposes upon a cabinet officer. But this was far from a universal impression among his cabinet. Boutwell believed that Grant gave him ample leeway, as he had given his wartime commanders. Fish disputed that Grant was a naive, bumbling president, saying he was the most scrupulously truthful man he had ever known, and had earnestly educated himself in every great question laid before him. For his White House entourage, Grant imported pretty much the same coterie of staff officers who had served him during the war and its aftermath. As with his cabinet, he favored personal secretaries with whom he felt comfortable, including Frederick Dent, Adam Badeau, Orville Babcock, Cyrus Comstock, and Horace Porter, as well as Robert Douglas, son of the late Senator Stephen Douglas. In these appointments, Grant demonstrated commendable loyalty for past services. As Eli Parker phrased it, "After the war was over, Grant showed his love for his military family by doing kindnesses for them whenever he could. When he became president, he sought them out, and without solicitation on their part, provided for many of them." Yet it was sometimes difficult to distinguish personal loyalty from cronyism. Many observers were disturbed by all the uniformed men striding the White House corridors. In a broad-brush indictment, Charles Sumner disapproved of the way the White House assumed the character of military headquarters, to the dishonor of the civil service and in total disregard of precedent. The president surrounded himself with officers of the army and substituted military forms for those of civil life. Among the administration's clandestine critics was William T. Sherman, who saw an unprepared Grant gravitating into a political sphere where he operated as a dangerous amateur. During the war, Grant had been a superb talent scout, winnowing out unqualified officers and advancing enterprising ones. Nevertheless, he had proven credulous with some personalities who didn't deserve his trust, and as president, he again showed little inkling of the opportunism that could afflict his staff as they faced the lure of peacetime riches and power. One such opportunist, although it took Grant many years to see it, was Adam Badeau. The one-time theater critic had an agile pen and was given his own White House room to compose an elaborate three-volume military history of Ulysses S. Grant, meant to enshrine his boss in the history books and contest lost-cause Southern analysts who glorified Lee at his expense. In time, Grant elevated Badeau to several diplomatic posts abroad, even as an underlying resentment festered inside the younger man. As early as March 1869, one White House staffer noted that Badeau had violently offended Grant by his pushing and presumption, the start of a rift that would silently widen in future years. In the end, the most troubling aide was Orville E. Babcock, who enjoyed the most intimate access to Grant. A popular, congenial 33-year-old with a Van Dyke beard, he was born in Vermont, graduated from West Point, and was a skilled engineer. For Grant, he had been a genuine war hero, fighting with gallantry at the Wilderness and Petersburg. Much like a chief of staff, Babcock occupied a second-floor White House office that enjoyed direct admittance to Grant's private study, so that, in General Sherman's words, he became a kind of intermediator between the people and the president. Grant trusted him so much that Babcock opened mail addressed to him and often sent replies himself. Babcock's influence rivaled that of cabinet secretaries, and only Rawlins enjoyed more confidential relations with the president. Unfortunately, where Rawlins qualified as a man of fiery principles, Babcock came to personify the looser morals of the Gilded Age. Though sometimes hoodwinked by close acquaintances, on other occasions Grant managed to combine personal favors with first-rate appointments. He made an excellent choice by tapping his old pal and ex-Confederate general James Longstreet as surveyor of customs for New Orleans. The rich patronage position seemed well-merited, for Longstreet was that rare Southern general who had preached cooperation with Reconstruction and been traduced as a scalawag for his outspoken courage. "Our new president has done many acts for which his country will hold him in grateful remembrance," wrote Horace Greeley, "but he never did a wiser or nobler act than his nomination yesterday of General James Longstreet." Grant personally shepherded the nomination through the Senate. "The senators have as many favors to ask of me as I have of them," he told Longstreet, "and I will see that you are confirmed." The Grants and Dents showed no scruples about badgering Grant for jobs, and he found it hard to avoid the perils of nepotism. Such favoritism was commonplace in the freewheeling atmosphere of 19th-century America. During the Civil War, the New York World had rapped Lincoln on the knuckles for having appointed his whole family to government posts. With an eye on the main chance, Jesse Root Grant had his son renew his appointment as postmaster of Covington. The pushy Jesse also lobbied for patronage jobs for friends, sought a fancy new post office in Covington, and bragged about his Washington connections. Not content to control Covington, he set himself up as a power broker in Ravenna, Ohio, where he favored for postmaster Eliza F. Evans, a soldier's widow and the daughter of an old friend, over an aspirant preferred by Congressman James A. Garfield. When Grant backed Mrs. Evans, Garfield didn't challenge him, but he disliked a meddling interloper such as Jesse Grant. In sketching this brawl, the New York World said archly that in future civil service exams, the Grant administration should list just two questions. Were you a contributor to either of Grant's three houses in Philadelphia, Washington, or Galena? And are you a member of the Dent family or otherwise connected by blood or marriage with General Grant? Grant was kept busy supplying jobs for Michael John Kramer, the Swiss-born Methodist clergyman who married his youngest sister Mary. During the war, Grant had wangled him a job as a hospital chaplain, followed by another at an army barracks in Covington after the war. As if such generosity were not enough, Grant conferred upon his brother-in-law the honor of being resident minister and chargé d'affaires in Denmark, where he would reside for 11 years. In many ways, the most lavish beneficiary of such largesse was the man least entitled to it, Colonel Dent, who had been invited by Grant to live in the White House. "The general was always so, so lovely to my dear father, and Papa was so proud of him," Julia wrote in her sometimes unreal, flowery style. Now in his early 80s, the colonel had never modified his Confederate views and remained a rabid Democrat. Before becoming president, Grant had paid off such sizable debts accumulated by his father-in-law that it mired him in financial obligations. For visitors to the executive mansion in the Grant years, Colonel Dent was ubiquitous, whether sunning himself on the porch or occupying his favorite spot near Grant's office and lecturing waiting politicians. At Blue Room receptions, he sprawled in an easy chair behind the President and First Lady, as if he were the grand old man of the administration. Despite a surface charm, the Colonel was still dogmatic about politics and said his son-in-law was really a staunch Democrat, but he doesn't know it. As in past years, the self-absorbed Jesse Root Grant and equally self-absorbed Colonel Dent continued to find each other insufferable, and Grant took refuge in his old strategy of passive detachment. With Colonel Dent monopolizing the White House, Jesse stayed at an inexpensive hotel when he visited Washington. The two men took turns insulting each other, pretending the other was a doddering old fool. "You should take better care of that old gentleman, Julia," Dent would say of Jesse Grant. "He is feeble and deaf as a post, and yet you permit him to wander all over Washington alone. It is not safe. He should never be allowed out without an attendant." To insult Jesse, Colonel Dent would pop out of his armchair whenever Jesse entered the room. "Accept my chair, Mr. Grant," he would say with elaborate courtesy, as if humoring a senile old man. Stiffly indignant, Jesse would reply in a stage whisper to a grandson, "I hope I shall not live to become as old and infirm as your grandfather Dent." Relations between the Dents and Grants, at a low ebb for 25 years, regressed even further. Cyrus Comstock reported that Julia was aggrieved by that old good-for-nothing J.R. Grant abusing her firmly to some correspondent. Grant's childhood friend Eliza Shaw reflected the rancor of the Grant family when she observed that old man Dent was a man without tact or respect for anybody. He was a fat old man, drank a good deal. She confirmed that Hannah Grant thought the Dents had captured the White House and boycotted Washington to avoid meeting them. Julia Grant was not on good terms with the general's mother. The general's mother was never in Washington because of this. She never came to see her son at the Capitol. As the Dent family guzzled freely at the patronage trough, the president more or less willingly catered to their thirst. One of Julia's brothers-in-law was made a bank examiner in Missouri, another a District of Columbia marshal, a third the collector of the Port of New Orleans. Her brothers also lined up for posts, with one made a customs appraiser in San Francisco, a second an Indian trader in New Mexico, and Brother Fred, one of Grant's secretaries. "A dozen members of the family billeted upon the country," Senator Sumner snorted in disgust. The subject of Grant and nepotism remains a puzzle. The practice hurt his standing and detracted from his better cabinet appointments. As Carl Schurz protested, Grant showed a disposition to give offices to all his relatives and to a great number of old personal friends, and in these instances to consult the members of Congress very little. That makes bad blood here and there. As Grant had shown during the war, he was personally incorruptible and never desired promotions that stemmed from wire-pulling. To keep the selection process pure, he had even refrained from consulting politicians about his cabinet choices. Yet he also had an unremitting sense of fidelity to family, even when they scarcely deserved it, and seemed unable to perceive how unfair such partiality might appear to most Americans. Having been battered by the world in his earlier years, he had come to rely on family and friends and never forgot that lesson. When he offered an appointment to a former St. Louis friend, the man felt obliged to point out that he was a Democrat. Grant waved away this concern. "Just before the Civil War," he said, "when I was standing on a street corner in St. Louis by a wagon loaded with wood, you approached and said, 'Captain, haven't you been able to sell your wood?' I answered, 'No.' Then you said, 'I'll buy it. And whenever you haul a load of wood to the city and can't sell it, just take it around to my residence, and I'll pay you for it.' I haven't forgotten it." Many of Grant's appointment problems also resulted from the absence of a true civil service, as patronage lubricated the system. In the motto enunciated by New York Senator William L. Marcy, "To the victor belongs the spoils." As Harper's Weekly noted on the eve of Grant's election, the chief business of the executive had become the distribution of patronage. In an era when strangers could walk straight into the White House, Abraham Lincoln had been besieged by job seekers who cluttered the stairs and corridors day and night. One day a friend asked Lincoln whether he was depressed because the Union Army had suffered a military setback. He smiled wanly and said, "No, it isn't the Army. It is the post office in Brownsville, Missouri." When an officer accompanied Lincoln to the opera and noticed how tired he looked, he asked the president whether he was enjoying the opera. "Oh, no, Colonel. I have not come for the play, but for the rest. I am being hounded to death by office seekers who pursue me early and late, and it is simply to get 2 or 3 hours' relief that I am here." Corruption was so endemic under Andrew Johnson that the 1868 Republican platform claimed he had perverted the public patronage into an engine of wholesale corruption. Grant quickly saw he would spend disproportionate time in fights over revenue collectors, Indian agents, postmasters, marshals, and customs collectors. Within weeks of becoming president, a harried Grant was already worn down by throngs of job claimants who stalked him everywhere. "I scarcely get one moment alone," he told his sister Mary. "Office seeking in this country is getting to be one of the industries of the age. It gives me no peace." Grant knew that for every friend he won through an appointment, he earned 100 enemies in rejected suitors. Under the spoils system, the president had to appease congressmen who dispensed patronage in their districts and grew powerful, perpetuating this unsavory system. Gideon Wells observed that corruption is not confined to one party. It is the disgrace and wickedness of the times. Despite such pressures, Grant made extraordinary strides in naming blacks, Jews, and Native Americans to federal positions, a forgotten chapter of American history. The minor story of nepotism has overshadowed this far more important narrative. 40 years before Theodore Roosevelt incurred Southern wrath by inviting Booker T. Washington to dine at the White House, Grant welcomed blacks there. On April 2nd, he met with the first black public official ever to visit the White House, Lieutenant Governor Oscar J. Dunn of Louisiana. On New Year's Day, citizens always lined up to pay their respects to the president. Before crowds started to arrive on January 1st, 1870, the police asked Grant whether they should honor the custom of having blacks and whites enter separately, and he said yes. When informed, however, that a number of colored people wished to come in with whites on an equal basis, Grant at once gave direction to admit all who wished to come, Babcock recalled. George T. Downing of the National Convention of the Colored Men of America told Grant that his followers placed special emphasis on black appointments, for they would give a death blow to objections against our holding such positions in the South by convincing the South that it is not true that the North wishes to force a policy upon them which it is not willing to accept itself. In response, Grant appointed Ebenezer D. Bassett as minister to Haiti, making him the first African-American diplomat in American history. The grandson of a slave, the Yale-educated Bassett had been principal of the Philadelphia Colored High School, where he joined with Frederick Douglass in enlisting 13 black regiments during the war. In soliciting Grant for the job, Bassett wrote that his appointment as a representative colored man would be hailed by recently enfranchised colored citizens as a marked recognition of our new condition in the Republic and an auspicious token of our great future. Frederick Douglass, who had entertained hopes for the Haitian post, graciously conceded defeat. "Your appointment," he told Bassett, "is a grand achievement for yourself and for our whole people." 2 years later, Grant expanded this precedent by naming James Milton Turner as minister to Liberia. Downing extolled Grant for surpassing Lincoln in naming numbers of our race to important positions, and giving a rebuke to vulgar prejudices against a class. In this you have gone far beyond our late lamented president. Grant's efforts transcended high-profile appointments, as he named a record number of ordinary blacks to positions during his first term in office. During the 1872 presidential campaign, Frederick Douglass toted up black employees sprinkled throughout the federal bureaucracy, citing customs collectors, internal revenue assessors, postmasters, clerks, and messengers, and was simply staggered by their numbers. "In one department at Washington, I found 249, and many more holding important positions in its service in different parts of the country." Grant integrated the executive mansion, appointing Albert Hawkins as his stable chief and coachman. He also cared for a Grant menagerie that included dogs, gamecocks, and a raucous parrot. For his personal servants, Grant picked George W. Bill Barnes and John Henry Whitlow. The able Barnes had been a runaway slave who showed up when Grant was in Cairo in 1861 and had turned himself into an indispensable valet. Mortified at memories of General Orders No. 11, Grant compiled an outstanding record of incorporating Jews into his administration, one that far outstripped his predecessors. The lawyer Simon Wolfe estimated that Grant appointed more than 50 Jewish citizens at his request alone, including consuls, district attorneys, and deputy postmasters, with Wolfe himself becoming recorder of deeds for the District of Columbia. When Grant made Edward S. Salomon governor of the Washington Territory, it was the first time an American Jew had occupied a gubernatorial post. When Salomon proved corrupt, Grant handled his case leniently, letting him resign. Elated at this appointment, Rabbi Isaac Meyer Wise said it showed that President Grant has revoked General Grant's notorious Order No. 11. Grant also introduced a crusading spirit in protecting Jewish rights abroad, even if it clashed with other foreign policy interests. In the past, such concerns had been criticized as interfering with the internal affairs of other nations. Now Grant set a new benchmark for fostering human rights abroad, growing out of his concern for persecuted Jews. In November 1869, reports surfaced that Russia had brutally relocated 2,000 Jewish families to the interior on smuggling charges, an episode faintly reminiscent of Grant's own wartime order. After conferring with American Jewish leaders, Grant responded in exemplary fashion. "It is too late in this age of enlightenment," he told them, "to persecute anyone on account of race, color, or religion." He protested to the Tsar while the American ambassador in Russia formulated a state paper documenting coercion against Russian Jews. The New York World professed satisfaction at how superior this Grant was to that General Grant who issued an order suddenly exiling all the Jews from their homes within the territory occupied by his armies. A still more menacing episode of anti-Semitism emerged in June 1870, with reports of fearful massacres against Romanian Jews, at least 1,000 of whom were said to have been murdered in a pogrom. The reports proved exaggerated. Walking over to the State Department, Grant ordered Fish to obtain full and reliable information in relation to this alleged massacre, and in the meantime to do all in his power to have the neighboring Turkish government stop such persecution. In discussing this Romanian bloodletting with Simon Wolfe, Grant declared that respect for human rights was the first duty of any head of state, and that blacks and Jews should be elevated to a rank of equality with the most enlightened. Grant showed surprising passion on the subject, saying, "The story of the sufferings of the Hebrews of Romania profoundly touches every sensibility of our nature." In December, Grant appointed Benjamin Franklin Peixotto, a Sephardic Jewish lawyer and journalist from San Francisco, as U.S. Consul General to Romania. Grant spelled out Peixotto's mission in a groundbreaking statement that stands as a landmark in American diplomatic annals. Mr. Peixoto has undertaken the duties of his present office more as a missionary work for the benefit of the people who are laboring under severe oppression than for any benefits to accrue to himself. The United States, knowing no distinction of her own citizens on account of religion or nativity, naturally believe in a civilization the world over which will secure the same universal liberal views. For the next 5 years, without an official salary, Peixoto performed major work investigating conditions in Romania and the Balkans, opposing anti-Semitism, and even providing sanctuary in his own home for Jews menaced by oppression. The unceasing pressure for federal jobs that confronted Grant at every step mirrored a far larger phenomenon: the vast transformation of American government wrought by the war. Federal power had expanded immeasurably, testing the president's ability to manage the change. The National Bank Acts, the Homestead Act, the Morrill Act, setting up land-grant universities. Such wartime measures dramatically broadened Washington's authority. Boasting 53,000 employees, the federal government ranked as the nation's foremost employer. Before the war, it had touched citizens' lives mostly through the postal system. Now it taxed citizens directly, conscripted them into the army, oversaw a national currency, and managed a giant national debt. As James M. McPherson has pointed out, 11 of the first 12 amendments to the Constitution constrained governmental power, starting with the 13th Amendment, 6 of the next 7 enlarged it. The war also centralized power, welding states closer together and forging a new sense of nationhood. As Grant told a relative, "Since the late Civil War, the feeling of nationality had become stronger than it had ever been before." When the first transcontinental railroad, aided by land grants and government bonds, was completed 2 months after Grant took office, it heralded a new geographic unity in American life. Fueled by war contracts, the northern economy had burgeoned into a mighty, productive engine that exploded with entrepreneurial energy, eclipsing the small-scale, largely agricultural antebellum economy, and catapulting the country into the front ranks of world powers. As the flush of wartime idealism faded, the Grant presidency ushered in the Gilded Age, marked by a mad scramble for money and producing colossal new fortunes. During the post-war boom, industrial trusts began to dominate one industry after another, creating growing inequalities of wealth and spawning a corresponding backlash from labor unions and the general public. New technologies, especially the railroad and telegraph, made the economy continental in scope, bringing forth modern industries and flooding the country with a cornucopia of consumer goods. The rise of big business required government assistance, providing fresh opportunities for graft to abound. With the federal government bound up in new money-making activities, there arose a gigantic grab for filthy lucre that affected state houses as well and saturated the political system with corruption. Businesses bargained for tax breaks, government contracts, land grants, and other favors, undermining democratic institutions that found it hard to withstand this assault. The mounting wealth also meant the dominant Republican Party was torn between its idealistic abolitionist past and its business-oriented future. In dealing with these changes, Grant inevitably bore a sizable load on his shoulders. He knew the post-war economic boom was uneven, the South having surrendered half its wealth, while 4 million freed slaves struggled to find their niche in American society. He had to deal with the paradox that, while demands upon the presidency had grown exponentially, the Congress-dominated system of the Johnson years had drastically weakened the executive branch. In the 19th century, Congress was infinitely more powerful than in the 20th, and senators ruled as headstrong barons whose power often rivaled that of presidents. Grant had a special political conundrum to figure out. The radical Republicans who formed his power base were the very people who had asserted congressional power during Andrew Johnson's impeachment. The deep-seated habit of promoting congressional prerogatives against the president would be fiendishly difficult to subdue, many senators having grown accustomed to exercising unchecked power. Although its population was swelling, much of the Washington over which Grant presided languished as undeveloped wasteland. "It is out at the elbows, shabby at the toes, generally dingy and neglected," griped a lady visitor. "There are vast, dreary, uninhabited tracts, destitute of verdure and roamed over by herds of horse cars and hacks." The soldiers who camped there during the war had leveled grass and bushes, leaving barren patches instead of parkland. Grant remembered the capital that year as "a most unsightly place, disagreeable to pass through in summer in consequence of the dust arising from unpaved streets, and almost impassable in the winter from the mud." Perhaps more than any other president, Grant oversaw the evolution of Washington from a straggling village into a modern city with well-paved sidewalks, sewers, and water and gas mains, enabling him to claim that it became one of the most sightly cities in the country, and can boast of being the best paved. Working with the vice chairman of the Board of Public Works, Alexander R. Shepard, Grant adorned public parks with trees and shrubbery, straightened a third of the city's roads, laid sidewalks where none had existed, introduced many streetlights, and signed legislation to finish the Washington Monument. With Orville Babcock heading the office charged with public buildings and grounds, Grant showed a surprisingly keen eye for government architecture and became so identified with a heavy, ornate design, the best example being the State, War, and Navy Building, now the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, adjacent to the White House, that it would be dubbed the General Grant style, as it was replicated at post offices and courthouses across America. The White House, then styled the Executive Mansion, required such thorough renovation that Julia Grant decided they should wait 2 weeks to move in while new wallpaper and carpets were installed. Because no West Wing or Oval Office yet existed, Grant held his cabinet meetings and kept his office on the second floor. His most noticeable additions to the mansion were a wood-paneled billiard room, rather solemnly decorated with stained glass windows and illuminated by gaslight chandeliers, and a pool set up on the south lawn that erupted with decorative water spray. Reflecting Republican hegemony, Grant removed the Thomas Jefferson statue from the north lawn, relegating it to Statuary Hall in the Capitol. Julia Grant expressed shock at her predecessor's housekeeping, and son Jesse recoiled at the dingy, shabby carpets and furniture in this new home. Since Grant was devoid of interest in interior decorating, Julia refurbished the White House, sprucing it up at considerable expense. She lavishly redecorated the East Room, swathing it in blue satin curtains and upholstery. Instead of Gilbert Stuart's portrait of George Washington in the Red Room, she hung a Grant family portrait that showed her grandly surrounded by her children, her uxorious husband standing stiffly to one side, a bit upstaged. Grant managed to get an equestrian portrait of himself hung in the Green Room. Finding the ushers and messengers unkempt in appearance, Julia decided to turn them out in dress suits and white gloves. She also cleared the south lawn, which had been a haunt for public loungers, slammed shut the iron gates, and created a beautiful lawn for her and the children, often overseen by the president as he smoked cigars on a porch rocking chair. Few first ladies, and the name wasn't yet commonly used, have so reveled in the White House or developed such a proprietary feeling about it. 8 happy years I spent there, so happy," Julia would reminisce. "It still seems as much like home to me as the old farm in Missouri, Whitehaven." By January 1, 1870, with the remodeling complete, Julia began to play hostess with a vengeance. The first and most brilliant early dinner came on January 26th. When the Grants entertained Prince Arthur, third son of Queen Victoria. Both British and American flags hung in the state dining room as guests munched their way through a dinner of Gilded Age luxuriance, 29 courses in all. Grant had imported an army chef whose idea of fine cuisine consisted of heavy slabs of roast beef and cheese piled high atop apple pie. Julia fired him and hired an Italian steward named Valentino Mella, who still plied groaning guests with up to 35 dishes in an evening, with a new wine introduced at every third course. He replaced roast beef with partridge and lighter delicacies. At the center of the state dining room stood a horseshoe-shaped table with a large, flower-draped mirror that, when angled, allowed Grant to screen himself from guests he especially wished to dodge. Because of the Civil War, the White House had acquired a lugubrious atmosphere under Lincoln, while the Johnson impeachment trial had further eroded social festivities in the Capitol. Now, with Julia's exuberant hospitality, the mansion emerged as the center of a splendid social scene. Each Tuesday afternoon, she received visitors, while her husband held evening receptions every other week. Julia developed the winning idea of inviting wives of cabinet secretaries, senators, and friends to assist her in greeting visitors on the receiving line, and, reversing long-standing tradition, she made sure they were incorporated into state dinners. Although faulted for extravagance, she never felt the least twinge of guilt on the subject. "I have visited many courts, and I am proud to say I saw none that excelled in brilliancy the receptions of President Grant." Julia also helped to democratize the White House. With her sociability offsetting her husband's shyness, she drew praise for her cordiality and openness to all guests. "Of all the public receptions at the Capitol, Mrs. Grant's weekly audiences are perhaps the most enjoyable and certainly the most peculiarly Republican gatherings," wrote one journalist, noting, "the poorest working woman was invited to join them. The conversation was lively and often unexpectedly provocative. Woman suffrage was the burning question of the hour, and in this Mrs. Grant showed great interest." One army officer believed Julia's strabismus handicapped her as a hostess. "Her somewhat impaired vision, with perhaps inability to recall the crowded past promptly, interfered in later years with her recognition of persons in power." Still self-conscious about being cross-eyed, Julia tended to pose for photographs in profile. To deal with her correspondence, she required a private secretary to assist her. Despite this drawback, she became a popular first lady who impressed the vast majority of visitors. As one cabinet member wrote after dining next to her, "She is intelligent, ladylike, and particularly pleased me by speaking of her husband as Mr. Grant." A touch of restlessness still characterized Mr. Grant, who rebelled against the hidebound etiquette that forced presidents to socialize only on their home turf. Scrapping this custom, he dined out regularly at the homes of cabinet members and old army comrades. Large numbers of friends were happy to reciprocate, stopping by the White House in the evening. After dinner, Grant loved to wander across Lafayette Square and drop by Hamilton Fish's house for casual conversation. "Few men had more powers of conversation and of narration than he when in the company of intimate friends," Fish remarked. As a result of interminable dinners, the once slender Grant developed a sleek, portly look, and his beard grew flecked with gray. Though conversational with close friends, he didn't look especially comfortable at White House social functions, trussed up in black evening coat and white tie, a one-time warrior ambushed by a sudden outbreak of peace. Shedding his levity, he nonetheless wore a downcast expression. "I observed a greater dignity of feeling," wrote Badeau, "a conscious and intentional gravity, an absence of that familiar, almost jocular mood which once had been so frequent." Grant lacked the useful glibness of many presidents, and could sometimes seem like a grudging prisoner of duty. He didn't impose himself upon people, or thrust himself into conversations, or demand to be the center of attention. As Badeau put it, Grant had little small talk and could not make conversation without a theme, but he observed closely under his mask of silence, and I always relished his criticisms of people and manners. Grant has labored under the charge of being an errand boy for plutocrats, turning his back on his roots in small-town America. Without question, he enjoyed fraternizing with prosperous businessmen, but he was also extraordinarily charitable toward the indigent, even though he never advertised his generosity. He gave to all who asked him, being often unnecessarily and unwisely profuse in his donations, said Fish. I have not infrequently known him to give sums from 5 to 10 times the amount of what the applicant could have reasonably or probably expected. His papers show a steady solicitude for the poor. The money routed anonymously through the Metropolitan Methodist Episcopal Church in Washington, where he worshipped regularly. Please give $10 to the blind man and $10 to the soldier's widow, went one note in 1869. In another, he wrote to the Reverend John P. Newman, please find enclosed my check for $100 for distribution among the poor. While wine flowed freely at state dinners, Grant didn't partake, and no alcohol was served when he dined in private. For New Year's Day receptions, he ordered that coffee instead of liquor be distributed. His political enemies still delighted in branding him a drunkard, the label now being the stock in trade of Grant critics. Ben Butler mocked Andrew Johnson as the drunken tailor, and Grant as the drunken tanner. When Orville Browning called on Grant one day, he found him very much bloated, eyes red and watering, and looking very much as if he were drunk, and I think he must have been pretty full. But such random accusations were now more conspicuous by their absence, and occurred with nowhere near the frequency of wartime drinking charges. The precise circumstances required for Grant's drinking binges, visits to distant cities, the absence of his wife, seldom applied during his presidency, when he was constantly surrounded by people, especially Julia. Admiral Daniel Ammen summed up Grant's presidency thus, during all of these years I never saw General Grant in a condition that would give rise even to a suspicion that he had indulged too freely in liquor, and only on one occasion have I ever had a glass of liquor in the White House. It was an extraordinary achievement that Grant, despite the almost unbearable tensions of his presidency and undoubted temptations to drink, largely conquered an alcohol problem that had beset him through much of his adult life. An active man, Grant often felt cooped up in the White House, where he worked from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. before escaping for a carriage drive. He showed his usual fondness for speedy trotters, sometimes driving so fast the timid Julia begged him to return her to the safety of the executive mansion. As Grant careened down roadways, pedestrians occasionally imagined he steered a runaway carriage. One day, riding down Pennsylvania Avenue with Sherman, Grant inquired, Sherman, what special hobby do you intend to adopt? Sherman was perplexed until Grant explained that newspapers liked to pin pet interests on people, and he had chosen horses as his hobby. That way, if a reporter pressed him for information he didn't wish to share, he could deflect the conversation to horsemanship. The anecdote suggests Grant was more artful and sophisticated in dealing with reporters than is commonly supposed. Perhaps his most remarkable extracurricular activities were his solitary walks around Washington, sometimes covering 5 or 6 miles. Grant disbanded his personal guard and sauntered around town alone, hands clasped behind his back, smoking a cigar. On these rambles he often passed Walt Whitman, then working in Washington. The poet told his mother, I saw Grant today on the avenue, walking by himself. I always salute him, and he does the same to me. He often spotted Grant frequenting a little cottage on the outskirts of town, where he had struck up a friendship with an elderly couple. I would see him leaning on their window sills outside. All would be talking together, they seeming to treat him without deference for place, with dignity, courtesy, appreciation. Far from seeing Grant as an elitist president or toady of the rich, Whitman thought he embodied a common democratic spirit. Grant was the typical Western man, the plainest, the most efficient, the least imposed upon by appearances. For Grant, the walks pierced the bubble inevitably isolating a president. On his constitutional one day, he noticed a commotion among a knot of government construction workers. When he asked what was the matter, he was told they were being forced to work 10-hour days, even though Congress had recently passed legislation introducing an 8-hour day for laborers employed by the federal government. Grant summoned the responsible figure, a Mr. Benjamin, for a dressing down, and notified him he should never again exact above 8 hours labor a day from his men. However frugal with government funds, Grant didn't allow it to interfere with his sense of justice for these workmen. On May 19, 1869, he issued a proclamation endorsing an 8-hour day for government laborers without any diminution of pay. It was yet another example that belies the charge that Grant had turned his back on ordinary working people. In his early days in Detroit, Grant had befriended Colonel James E. Pittman, who told the following tale of Grant on one of his walks. He used to meet a lady every morning as she was coming out of the Treasury building. He bowed to her, and she bowed to him, but never spoke. One day he stepped before her. "See here, why don't you stop and speak to me?" "But, General," she answered, "I supposed you wanted to be alone, and I didn't want to intrude." Grant smiled and said, "Don't you suppose I would rather have people stop and talk with me than let me walk alone?" There is a hint here of Grant's admiration for a pretty woman, and also a hint of his essential loneliness. This trait he had even as a young officer in Detroit. As part of his health regimen, Grant escaped from the sweltering Washington summers by withdrawing to Long Branch. A miasmic breeze, he believed, blew from flats south of the White House, communicating disease to its occupants. His friend George W. Childs, the editor of the Philadelphia Public Ledger, had joined with George Pullman and other well-off friends to purchase the shingled three-story cottage on Ocean Avenue, perched on a bluff, which effectively became the first summer White House. Grant was allowed to use the house free of charge for life and bought it in his name. Described by one reporter as a mixture of English villa and Swiss chalet, it was encircled by verandas and dormer windows that provided fine ocean vistas. Not nearly as fancy as Newport, Long Branch exuded an informal charm and gaiety, despite its heavy contingent of bankers and industrialists. Brass bands thumped out tunes on the local hotel lawn, while scores of red, white, and blue flags rippled in the salt air. Grant responded to the genial sea breeze, fine roads, and beautiful surrounding villages, and pleasant and hospitable neighbors. At Long Branch, he felt blithe as a schoolboy, and loved to flaunt feats of strength. There was a chin-up bar at the ferry house where he startled his family by performing 25 or 30 repetitions. Clad in a linen duster, he drove fast buggies on the beach or scooted off to neighboring towns, often logging in 20 miles before breakfast. Other times he drifted down to the ocean alone and stared pensively at the sea, smoking his cigar. Grant ran into criticism for spending too much time at his Long Branch hideaway, but he kept up an ample work schedule there and was often visited by cabinet secretaries. The beach house became for him an irreplaceable sanctuary from the pressures of office. Ever since the war, the Grant family had suffered from a vagabond existence. With the two eldest boys away at school, Long Branch provided a cherished haven where the Grants functioned as a true clan, bathing in the surf, enjoying clam bakes, and entertaining visitors. Since Grant was a young president, the press delighted in the rambunctious antics of his teenage children, ranging from 18-year-old Fred to 11-year-old Jesse. "I have never seen a more devoted family, or a happier one," observed the White House usher William Crook. "There never seemed to be the slightest jar." As in Galena days, Grant would playfully knead his bread into little balls at meals and fire them at Nellie and Jesse, who resided in the White House. "When the missile hit, he went over and kissed the victim on the cheek," said Crook. "He was a most loving father." Grant's oldest son, Fred, who was at West Point, showed strikingly similar interests to his father's. He excelled at math, adored horses, and loved parade ground drills. Besides the physical resemblance, he had his father's laconic style and bull-headed drive. The second son, Buck, displayed his father's strength and simple, straightforward manner. Nellie was pretty and sweet and pampered by her doting father. At one point, to instill more discipline in her, the Grants sent her to Miss Porter's school in Farmington, Connecticut, where she revolted at her unwanted exile and soon returned to the mad flurry of Washington parties. The child providing reporters with the most captivating copy was Jesse, whom his father called a saucy little rascal, and who didn't go to school until age 9, having had private tutors instead. Inheriting his father's taste for fast horses, Jesse drove a pair of Shetland ponies in a little buggy crafted by his father. He was constantly at Grant's side during his White House rounds. "Father was with me on walks, talks, stargazing, stamp collecting, raising pets, playing ball, and other pastimes." The stargazing referred to a telescope Jesse had mounted on the White House roof, where he and his father studied the universe. Stamp collecting was another of the boy's hobbies, and he was outraged when he sent $5 to a Boston company for foreign stamps that never arrived. Grant prevailed upon a local police officer named Kelly, assigned to the executive mansion, to see justice done. "I am a capital policeman. I can arrest anybody, anywhere, at any time, for anything," Kelly wrote on White House stationery with mock menace to the company. "I want you to send those stamps to Jesse Grant right at once." Jesse shortly got a bumper crop of stamps. It wasn't yet the custom for first ladies to champion causes, but Julia Grant exerted quiet influence behind the scenes. She didn't try to butt in on policy decisions where her knowledge was limited, but she readily detected false or treacherous figures and strove to protect her husband from the pervasive intrigue around a president. "She soothed him when cares oppressed him," wrote Badeau. "She supported him when even he was downcast." Whenever she thought he needed advice or support, she would scribble a little note and slip it into an envelope marked on top, "The President Immediate." Whereas Grant accepted his presidential tenure with a certain ambivalence, the stout, buxom Julia thrived during her White House tenure, referring to it as a bright and beautiful dream that she hoped might last forever. Julia made varied impressions on people. Before she became First Lady, one journalist commended her as a sunny, sweet woman, too unassuming to be a mark for criticism, while many others complimented her tact, warmth, and hospitality. Another vein of commentary chided her, however, for being bossy and autocratic, too impressed with her own prerogatives. Some remembered her berating servants. Eliza Shaw recalled her scolding her coachman because the carriage was muddy. The author Olive Logan was blunt about her shortcomings. She was not well liked. She applied herself at once to finding out her privileges and was not slow in asserting them. Since he adored his wife, Grant was largely blind to these flaws, treating her like a young bride. He escorted her, arm in arm, to breakfast each morning and reenacted the same ceremony for the evening meal. Julia conjured up images of domestic bliss, leaving this vignette of the family's quiet time together before dinner. "I was generally lying on the bed, resting among my pillows before making my toilet. The general usually sat near the head of the bed, smoking his favorite cigar. Fred, feeling sure of his welcome, stretched himself across the foot. Ulysses, Buck, sat on a lounge at the foot of the bed, while Nellie and Ida, later Fred's wife, took their comfort in great cushioned chairs."